Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for tuning in. This is Tamina Watson, your host of Tamina Talks Immigration. Welcome. This summer, I decided to record a series called Legal Heroes in the Trump Era. I wanted to speak with some of the lawyers who have stepped up beyond their day jobs to make a difference in immigration, civil rights, and much more. I wanted their insights from their work in the last 4 years so we can learn lessons to take into the future, especially as one of the most consequential elections in America lies ahead. The interview series became a book called Legal Heroes in the Trump Era, The Inspired, Expand Your Impact, Change the World. The book can be found on Amazon and other outlets. I hope you will pick it up. Enjoy these interviews. I hope you'll learn a lot. Thank you so much for listening.
Hey, podcast listeners. Be sure to tune into Tamina Talks Immigration, where immigration attorney Tamina Watson discusses the latest on immigration news and issues. She talks to those who have impacted U.S. immigration laws and policies, as well as notable immigrants who have made great contributions. Check out Tamina Talks Immigration to also hear your questions be answered. Subscribe now for the latest on everything and anything immigration.
The Legal Heroes series of interviews were conducted during the summer of 2020. This particular interview was recorded on June 26th. Please keep that in mind as you hear any topical references. Enjoy the show.
I am so honored to have this amazing guest today. Her name is Tracy Fight Love. She is the founder and president of Lawyers for Good Government, and she has been doing some amazing work that you should all know about. Tracy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
You know, we haven't actually had a one-to-one chat yet, but I feel as though we've been talking a lot, only because of all the work we have both been doing. I think some of the work that we've been doing has been in parallel, and I cannot wait for you to talk about all of that. But before we dive into what you've been doing in the last 3.5 years, I would love the listeners to get to know you a little. Where were you born and where did you grow up?
Let's see. I was born in Portsmouth, Virginia, in a Navy hospital. My dad was serving in the Navy as a dentist at the time. And when I was 2 years old, we moved to the Baltimore, Maryland area, which is where I grew up.
And is that where you still are?
No, now I'm in outside Atlanta, in Georgia.
Oh, okay, cool. Did you always want to be a lawyer?
It's tricky. The first time I said I wanted to be a lawyer, I was maybe 8 or 9 years old and said I wanted to be an international corporate attorney, which I think I got from LA Law. I'm not sure. At the time, I also wanted to be a singer and a waitress, so I don't know what that's worth. But in the end, I did over time realize that being a lawyer was the career for me. So that's how I ended up here.
And what did you want to accomplish as a lawyer?
You know, it really changed over time. In college, I was very active in women's rights. I was a women's rights major. So I founded the first gender equity group at the University of Delaware, which is where I was in undergrad, did a lot of work with sexual assault survivors, and thought that's what I was going to focus on. By the time I got to law school and I started thinking about areas of focus, I started out doing a paper on the impact of the war on drugs on women, but I was really struck when I looked by the data at the extent to which that effect differs depending on if we're talking about white women or black women or women of color. So I ended up writing a paper that covered the varying impacts on those different groups, and I thought I might do something along those lines. Over time, I came to think of my legal career as also the way I would support my family. I had my daughter in 2008, and I think from then on, I really was very focused for many years on just raising her and figuring out a way as the sole breadwinner to keep her going, to support her. So it really wasn't until 2016 that all of that changed for me. I didn't have one set path. I feel like I ended up here after a series of events that in retrospect looked like they led me here. But at the time, I really didn't know that this is where I was going to end up.
You know, you bring 2016, and I was going to ask you, where were you on the night of the election? And what do you remember about that night?
I was with my daughter. She was 8 years old, and we had spent the day going out to different grocery stores to buy supplies for what we thought was going to be a party that just the two of us were going to have at our place. And the idea was to celebrate what we thought would be the election of the first woman president. And I was so, naively optimistic about the outcome of the election that I actually got my daughter really excited about it as well. So that's where I was. I remember it very clearly, the two of us looking at the TV and me not knowing what to tell her as the results came in and realizing that my party celebration was somewhat premature. So we had to figure out from there what to do.
You, me, and many, many people actually on this series have confirmed that very sentiment, actually. So, you know, we were all in shock. You were in shock. Tell us a little bit about what happened in the days following the election.
Well, for me, you know, the same night of the election came time to get my daughter Carly to bed. And as I was putting her to bed, she looked up at me. She looked really scared. And that made me feel terrible for even talking to her about any of this in the first place. But she said to me, "What are we going to do now?" Because she'd heard all of my commentary over the course of the campaign about the rhetoric that was coming out of the Trump campaign. And so she was genuinely scared, which I think reflected on her part my fear about what a Trump presidency would look like and what that would mean.
So were you still in private practice at this point?
No, actually, I only practiced law for a few years at DLA Piper. I was a commercial litigation associate in their Boston office. And after that, I moved to a position running a startup from home. I really was looking for a job that I could do. It was a legal-related startup, but it was much more focused on recruiting, marketing, digital media. And that set me on a path where between 2007 and 2016, I really gained a lot of experience in all things online marketing, online organizing, although it was in a for-profit context, understanding how to use digital tools to work as part of a remote team, a distributed team, email, you know, mass email communications. So I was doing all of that. And at the time of the election, I was working for a company that basically did online reputation management for small to medium-sized law firms. That's what I was doing in that moment.
Okay. I wanted to set the context because what you've done since is phenomenal and we needed to know where you were at that time. So please continue. You put your child to sleep and then...
Yeah. And then I went online because, you know, it was just me there, single mom. And I just went online. I went to Facebook. I was looking in different groups of people, mainly women, who, you know, we had been talking on social media over the course of the election. And so that's where I went to see what people were talking about and what ideas different people had. By the time I managed to fall asleep, I really only slept a couple of hours. And when I woke up, I immediately went back online. I kind of had this dream that when I would wake up, I would realize that the previous night had been a dream or a nightmare, or I would find out that there was a recount or something. So as soon as I woke up, before I even got out of bed, I was on my phone and, oh my God, this is actually happening. So that day and that night, I was back on mainly Facebook because that's where I'd been active in terms of social media. And it was that day that I started noticing a pattern, which was there were a lot of groups where a lot of people were commiserating, really, about the result of the election and sharing very emotional responses. And what I noticed was every 10 or 15 posts, and the posts would be, oh my God, this is terrible. Oh no, what are we going to do? I'm so devastated. I'm so angry. All of which were valid. And I felt the same way. But then there would be a post from a lawyer, usually a woman lawyer, because I guess that's who was in these groups that I was part of. And you would see things that were so different. Someone would come in to the group and say, okay, we need to organize. Here are some things I think we need to do. And immediately it would be, you know, 5-step action plans, 10 ideas. People had ideas all over the spectrum. But I watched these ideas come and go, right? They would show up on the feed and then it would just get pushed down the page. It would get a couple of likes, a couple of comments, you know, more commiseration, and then another post. And it gave me this idea of there has to be a way to consolidate these posts and these conversations so that specifically lawyers who have ideas about how to take action can talk to one another and we can figure out some sort of a game plan. And that's really what prompted me to put up the post on my Facebook profile that led to what has become Lawyers for Good Government. And all it was very basic. All I said was, if you're a lawyer, you're unhappy with the outcome of the election, and you'd like to talk with other lawyers about what we can collectively do in defense of our democracy and our core values starting in January, let me know. And so many people started replying. My post had to become a group. The group, people just started sharing it. You know, I thought I was going to get 25, 30 attorneys into a group. And instead, by the end of 72 hours, there were 60,000 lawyers in the group. In 3 weeks, there were 125,000, which was 10% of the nation's lawyers. I mean, it so quickly became something so different from what I envisioned that it required a complete overhaul of my entire life, really, at that moment. You know, over that 3 week period, I decided to leave my job, which was, you know, basically a startup with several people that I'd been working with for years as part of a team. So that was a big decision, and decided to put everything I had into figuring out how to maximize the potential of this incredible group of people that had come together. And I honestly didn't know what that looked like. And I was very upfront about that. You know, in the group, I started out with, okay, we're here. Let's approach this in a really organized way. And how do you organize 125,000 people, let alone lawyers? Started with a survey, just started talking and asking and polling. 15,000 lawyers took the survey. And from there, it really took off. I mean, that's how we started.
That's truly amazing in that little amount of time. And, you know, just to, so you know what was happening here in Washington State, at least from my bedroom and my room, I had very similar thoughts. And for a week, I just cried and sort of thinking, what do I do? I had a series of dinners. And at the dinners, we were having exchanges of ideas and just commiserating. And by the end of that week, you know, I'm like, well, if I, and I, but by the way, I was part of the Hillary Clinton Immigration Working Group. And so I knew what was going to happen in the first 100 days, helping write memos. And so, you know, the devastation was so enormous. And then I went to our AILA chapter and said, you've got to give us a committee. And so that next week, they gave me a committee. And then I just started to put things in place, just like you were doing, but very local, knowing that the rhetoric about immigration was just so awful that even if a little tiny bit of that were to come true, everybody's going to have to step in. And, you know, what I did recognize is everybody's going to need immigration lawyers, yet we don't have enough. Yep. What to get organized. So, you know, that was happening, you know, in a parallel world practically. And so then what happened? So you had 125,000 people, you left your job. I mean, what, you know, I want to say sacrifice, because suddenly, did you just say you're a single mom, so, you know, breadwinner, and you left your job to tackle democracy? How did you come to that decision?
It wasn't easy. And I'm very fortunate and privileged to have a family that was willing to back me up. So, you know, it's not the same as someone who, you know, had no one to turn to. And I want to say that up front. Not everyone could have been in a position to do, you know, what I did. It was definitely a risk, because it's not that my family is in a position to support me endlessly. But I was able to get their support that if it took me a month or two to get it off the ground, that we would be okay, that my daughter and I would be okay. And that was a very fortunate position to be in. But it was a big risk for me personally and professionally. I had really been on a very specific path for many years, and this was all new. I just, on some level, knew that I had to do it. It didn't really feel like a choice so much as this moment calls for this action. I didn't see another route, and I couldn't fathom the possibility of just going back to what I was doing before and then leaving the group to fend for itself and hoping that something good came out of it. It just felt like something I had to do. So that was the path I went down. And I just believed that with this much energy and this much support, there had to be a way. Immediately, I started educating myself and talking to people and understanding what would it take to turn this group into an actual organization? What would it mean to set this up as a nonprofit? You know, what form should it be in? There were amazing people who stepped up, three of whom became the founding board of directors. Could not have done any of this without them. I mean, and these were three people who I had no contact with before the Facebook group. I met all of them through the group, all amazing people, and they worked with me. And we had conversations that went for hours. During that time frame, there was not much sleep happening, but we just kept talking and brainstorming and connecting with potential partners. I mean, it was really important to speak with people who had been doing this type of work for a long time. I really wanted to understand what is already being done and where can this group of lawyers make a difference. It was very important to me that we not, you know, there were many of us that became more politically active in 2016, but there were many who had been politically active for years. And it was important to me that we not suddenly try to, you know, burst in and try to take anything over or duplicate work that's already being done. So a lot of it was really kind of a market assessment, you know, understanding what the needs were. Why did people join the group? You know, why were they interested in organizing in this way rather than just volunteering with an existing organization or an existing initiative? The survey was really important. There was one big survey and then a bunch of surveys after that to learn how people wanted to get involved, how they wanted to organize. We ended up putting together a conference the day, it started the day of the Women's March after the march was over in DC. And then it was a full day of programming the following day. That conference became a huge point of focus for us in the time leading up to the inauguration. We had 1,000 members of the group who showed up in DC to march together as part of the Women's March. And then we had our own event the following day, which again, about 1,100 people attended. And that was a really important moment because that was when I think a lot of us realized this isn't just a Facebook group. We became a real community, even though it wasn't anywhere close to the full group that got together. It was enough of us that when we connected and reconnected back in the group, it just felt more concrete and more real. We'd had a lot of interesting conversations. We'd heard from a lot of leaders in their respective issue areas, and that really guided us. But very soon after that, the Muslim ban was announced. And I have to say, since that time, a lot of what we have done and what I think we've become good at is figuring out how to respond very quickly to a crisis situation or to a situation where hundreds or thousands of lawyers all of a sudden are needed all at the same time. And I didn't know when we started out that that was going to be what we ended up becoming really good at, but that's how it happened. And the very first instance of that was in response to the Muslim ban when our Facebook group kind of became a coordinating hub for a lot of the lawyers that ended up showing up at airports and trying to make a difference that way. And our immigration work took off really from there.
And it was very impressive. I mean, you know, hundreds of lawyers had descended on every airport in the country. And I don't know if you know, but I was running the response committee at the time. And then soon thereafter, collaborating with some people, we started airportlawyer.org, which, you mm-hmm. know, essentially had volunteer lawyers meet passengers and help them. And it really was a turning point in how quickly we would have to act and how innovative we have to be, because the same old mm-hmm. wouldn't necessarily work for these unprecedented yeah. situations. And you've demonstrated what a knack you have for identifying and quickly going in and then acting on it. So kudos for that. And that went on for some time. And so give us a little description of, like, let's talk about timelines here. That was January 2017. And then mm-hmm. the Muslim ban was finally, you know, allowed by the Supreme Court. Was it June, July? Time is a blur now. But it was a good 6 months.
Yeah, that's how that whole thing feels. When I look back at the early, you know, even just the first 2 years, the whole thing feels very blurry. Just a whirlwind of activity, so many conversations, very little sleep. But it was also one of the most exciting times of my life and put me on this path where I feel there's nothing in my life that compares to running this organization. So yeah, it's a huge blur. But I feel very fortunate that I got to be a part of that blur somehow.
You know, I feel the same way. I think living in this particular time in history where we've actually been able to make a concrete difference, it feels like a privilege to me that you were in the right place at the right time with the right support, because I totally agree. Yeah. If you didn't have the infrastructure of support around you for your family, you would not be able to do something like this. You know,
no.
You have to really think about the mortgage and the food on the table. You know, pro bono is not something that you can actually afford to do. So I feel very much the same. And so let's talk a little bit about some of the actions you've taken, because immigration has been a very big part of it. So I want you to talk about that. But I also want you to talk a little bit about the other legal areas you focused on, because the number of people, lawyers that you have in the group are not limited to immigration. It's every type of law. But at the same time, every type of law is under assault, and you've been able to tackle all of them. So give us some idea of what you've been doing.
Sure. And how it turned out, I mean, in the beginning, when I did that initial survey, I asked the members of the group to rate basically 30 different issue areas, scale of 1 to 10. You know, how likely would you be personally to want to do some work in this issue area? And I thought that would guide our decisions about what issues to focus on. But it turned out that almost all the scores for all the issues were the same. Every issue was rated like 9.1, 9.2, 8.9. And so what ended up guiding our work was really the need. And so what I've done is look for the intersection of where there's an immediate need and where we have a specific skill set and a specific set of assets to contribute. And so I found that to be the case in the immigration arena, where there was a huge need, and I believed what we brought to the table as an organization meant we could make a difference in that area. A similar thing happened with respect to climate change under the leadership of Jillian Blanchard, an L4GG member and the director of our climate change program now. That came about directly in response to the decision by the Trump administration to pull the United States out of the Paris Climate Accord. And so climate change became an area of focus. And since then, you know, hundreds of lawyers have volunteered, and we've done some good work, I think, in the climate change space. We focused most recently on a response to COVID-19. It became apparent that there were small businesses, and for our purposes, it was really the micro businesses and nonprofits that we were most interested in helping, who were so affected and impacted by the pandemic and desperately needed guidance from a lawyer about, in the beginning, you know, how to access the new federal grants and loans that were becoming available, over time, how to deal with employment law issues, insurance issues, contract issues, commercial leases. And so in response to the pandemic, we ended up putting together remote legal clinics. We did it on a region by region basis. And so we're now up and running in 9 states across the country, always in partnership with a local nonprofit in the area and a number of law firms. So we're doing that legal clinic, and that's ongoing. And voting rights has also been a big area for us, which now is part of our Lawyers for Racial Justice initiative, which is just getting off the ground. So those are some of the big areas where we've done some work. There have been other areas where we've done, you know, in January, we did an event in DC pushing for a fair impeachment trial, which of course didn't happen. But the big areas of focus are the ones I've just shared.
Can you share a little bit about the work you're doing at the border?
Sure. Yeah. So when we started in our doing immigration, we, you know, in a major way, the airport work was one thing. But when we decided to really put a lot of our resources into it was when we created Project Corazon, which is our immigrants' rights program. That started in 2018 when the news of, you know, family separation and kids in cages and horrible conditions and all of those things were starting to become more apparent to people across the country who really didn't know that this kind of thing was going on. And since that time, the projects that we've done have been, you know, for the most part, in partnership with other organizations. So, you know, we partnered with Raices, for example, who had an amazing program at the Carnes Detention Center to help prepare detained asylum seekers for their credible fear interviews. What they asked of us was to see if we could provide remote representation for those credible fear interviews for as many of the detainees that came through Carnes as we could. It was a complicated project, but since then we've been able to provide representation for more than 1,300 detained asylum seekers in Carnes, all remotely. And so that's an example of a partnership program. The work we're doing physically at the border, which is focused on the Matamoros area directly across from Brownsville, Texas, came about in part because we received an influx of funding, grassroots funding, last summer that made it possible for us to actually staff a position there. And so unlike the mainly partnership-focused projects we had done before that, we ended up creating a legal clinic for asylum seekers in Matamoros. It's now under the leadership of the program director, Charlene DeCruz, as well as her support, full-time paralegal, both bilingual, both amazing people, both of whom picked up and relocated their entire lives to move to Brownsville, Texas, so that they could do this work. And as a result of that, we've been able to help, I think, more than 1,000 asylum seekers just from the Matamoros area. And still, the program is ongoing. I got to give Charlene and Carla credit. You know, when COVID-19 hit, they had to figure out how do we keep going, because they were at the time crossing into Matamoros every day to meet personally, one-on-one, with asylum seekers. That was no longer possible. But because most of our, in fact, all of our infrastructure is online, because we're a remote organization, we have no headquarters, no physical office, they said they were able to transition. So they streamlined the process, they transitioned everything, and they've been working remotely, really with no interruption in service to the asylum seekers since then. So we're on the ground in Matamoros, and Charlene is running programs that allow us to mobilize pro bono attorneys from all over the country. So her, you know, she and Carla handle the intakes and the screening, they review the files, and then they identify pro bono attorneys to take those matters remotely, including, you know, 589s, immigration appeals, and some other matters.
That's very impressive. What an operation that you've started from scratch. And it all started November 2016. And none of us could have predicted that an administration would tear away a baby from the baby's mother.
No.
You know, and as young as 4 months, it sounds like. Was there a younger child than 4 months? I don't remember. And that has been what has driven a lot of lawyers, particularly lawyer mothers, to, you know, basically say enough is enough, because, you know, we could imagine, or we cannot imagine, our children in that situation. And so it's been a very interesting time in history, for sure. And a lot of lawyers have poured out and found a way to help through Lawyers for Good Government. Can you speak a little bit about that? One of the things that I have noticed is that, you know, we all go to law school with some idealisms about we're going to change the world, and then life kicks in and you've got bills to pay and, you know, children to raise and, you know, deadlines to meet. And we've sort of been, you know, going along life until November 16 hit. And I see it with me, I've seen it with some colleagues. What have you seen in the change of lawyering?
Yeah, I mean, I think there certainly were a lot of us, including me, who were not anywhere near as active in this space prior to November 2016 as we are now. In my own case, you know, looking back, I realized, you know, at least in part, I think for me, it was definitely that I was in a privileged position. I had the privilege of sort of disconnecting from politics in a way that I deeply regret now with what I've learned over the past several years. But I think the important thing for all of us that are showing up now is that we're showing up now, and we have to do the best we can to get plugged in, to make a difference, to contribute what we have, and also to actively seek out and learn from people who have been doing this work far longer than any of us. So that's advice I give generally, and that I work very hard to follow myself.
Would you call this legal activism?
I would. I mean, I'm not sure if there's an official definition of activism that would preclude this from being considered that, but I think, to me, activism is when you're taking a stand and directly taking action in order to make a change, whether that's a change for one person, you know, one asylum-seeking family in Matamoros, or a systemic change, trying to get the laws changed or the process changed or the policy changed in a way that helps thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of people. And I think every lawyer who's doing that deserves credit and support. And I hope as many of us as possible will keep doing it, because there's only so many of us. That was something that really hit home for me when the Facebook group started forming, is there's not actually that many lawyers when you think about it. If there's 1.25 million of us, and some of us are just starting out, and some of us are retired, and some of us are in law school, you know, depending who you count, that means that for all of the issues and all of the legal areas that need some type of help, there's really a fixed number of us to go around. And so it takes all of us doing whatever we can and bringing whatever we can to the table. And my, you know, big part of my goal with L4GG is to try to facilitate that, you know, to try to give lawyers more ways to get involved, more ways to make a difference. And it doesn't always look the same. You know, sometimes it's volunteering to take an immigration case. Sometimes it's doing pro bono work on a research project. And sometimes, quite frankly, it's donating to the organizations that are doing the work. I never want any lawyer to think that a donation doesn't count or doesn't make a difference, because I know firsthand, and I'm sure you do as well, in the nonprofit space, everything we do is made possible by those donations. And so those are important too. I wouldn't say a donation necessarily is activism, but I do think it's an important piece of the puzzle. And if calling it activism helps support it, then I encourage that, because we all need to do whatever we can. And sometimes that's what people can do.
And, you know, I'll add to that, that as I was, you know, getting lawyers to where they needed to be in the first 12 months of this administration, and, you know, it was this legal clinic that needed 10 lawyers and that legal clinic that needed 5 lawyers or that presentation. And I just took it upon myself to be the pestering voice on our listserv. But what I did realize is that the energy was depleting. And one of the things that was on the campaign trail was mass deportation. And if he's already done Muslim ban and he's all done all these other things, mass deportation was waiting to happen. And, you know, luckily, we've not seen it in the way that he has campaigned, although we're seeing it in different ways where it's inadvertently happening. But my thought was, what do I do when I get the call for 30 lawyers to turn up at immigration court? That's not going to happen.
Yeah.
And it was that realization that drove me for 18 months to sort of figure out how to create the Washington Immigrant Defense Network. And it was this very thing that there are not enough of us. And if you say that there are 125 or whatever million, 100 thousands of lawyers there are, immigration lawyers as a subset is even smaller. Yeah. And that's where the majority of the assault has happened. And we simply not have enough immigration lawyers to tackle it. So what you have done truly is bringing the collaboration into an area that has been desperate for re-energizing, but also just physical work. And so kudos for that. But again, every area of law has needed that, and it will continue to need that. So question for you about lawyers who are looking to do something more. What would you give as guidance?
I mean, it's hard to say briefly, but I'll do my best. I would say first is don't feel you have to do everything at once. You know, I think one of the things that stops people sometimes from taking action is feeling like, oh, there's so much that needs to be done. It's so big. How could I choose between this and that? There's so many opportunities. And I think that sometimes too many opportunities is overwhelming. So I would say, you know, it's perfectly fine to choose one issue area where you feel like you can make a difference, because it's not about what any one of us is doing. It's what all of us collectively are doing. Some of us are going to focus on this issue, some on that. So choose something. Don't let the overwhelming nature of the opportunities stop you from making that decision. Choose something, look into which organizations are doing good work, you know, in that space, because there are so many organizations doing amazing work in most of these issue areas. So find out what they're doing, reach out. I would also say it's really important for volunteers not to be discouraged if they don't immediately hear something back. I think that's another thing that happens. You know, lawyers decide to volunteer, and as lawyers, our time is valuable. And so when a lawyer makes the decision to volunteer, they want to say, you know, I want my effort to be appreciated. I want them to immediately reach out and give me an opportunity. And I don't blame them for feeling that way. But at the same time, think about it from the organization standpoint. You know, if an organization is staffed up for normal day-to-day, and then all of a sudden there's a crisis or something in the media, and all of a sudden now 1,000 more lawyers want to get involved with something, that organization you're reaching out to probably isn't staffed for that. So I would say, you know, reach out, fill out the forms, volunteer, and then be patient. And when you get the call, if you can step up, do. I mean, that's really the best advice I can give. And in between volunteering, do what you can to support the organizations that are doing the work in other ways.
Well said. And we're running out of time. But in my opinion, the time between now and November 2020 is critical. We've, you know, seen a lot of policy changes coming through, including a travel ban that just happened this week. And in my opinion, it's actually the worst of all. What other things should we look out for, and what can lawyers do, if anything? I mean, you talked about voting rights. You talked about, I don't know if you talked about protest or being observers. There are some concrete things that people can do that wouldn't be necessarily time consuming. Can you maybe throw out a few lists?
Sure. And, you know, I was thinking about, and I get asked this question a lot, you know, what are the most important things for people to do? And I don't know that I can give the definitive list of most important things. All I can do is say what's on my mind. And that is, each of us needs to be doing everything that we can between now and November to try and make sure, first off, that the elections are fair, that every person who has the right to vote is able to cast their vote and have their vote counted, and completely separate from my organization. We each have an obligation, I think, to campaign for the candidates that we believe will create the change that we want to see. And so I would say, do what you can, right? Voting rights work, voter registration, and even campaigning, not necessarily a legal activity, but supporting the campaigns of the candidates that you think will bring the change that you want to see. We each have to be focused on all of those things between now and November.
Thank you, Tracy. Very well said, and I couldn't agree more. We all have a duty to make our country better and also for the future of our children. You know, I do think that this is one of the most critical elections in the country, but also for the world. So, Tracy, thank you so much for this, you know, incredibly interesting discussion. And I could talk to you all day long. And I hope you'll come back. Maybe we'll have another chat, you know, November to see what needs to be done, whether it's this way or that way. Either way, there's a lot of work that will need to be done. And so thank you for everything that you do. Thank you for making a profound difference in our country, in every legal area, and for lawyers to step up, and you've given them a pathway to actually, you know, help. And so thank you for that. And thank you for being on the show.
Thank you. No, thanks for everything you do. And of course, I'd be remiss if I didn't say to anyone watching, lawyersforgoodgovernment.org, sign up for updates if you're interested in finding out more about how to get involved. But thank you so much for having me today.
Thank you.
Tamina Talks is brought to you by Watson Immigration Law. Founded in 2009, Watson Immigration Law is one of Seattle's premier immigration firms, specializing in business and investment visas, but offering a wide range of immigration services. If you need assistance with your immigration needs, Watson Immigration Law is ready to help. Just call 206-292-5237 to schedule an appointment. Mention this podcast to receive a 10% discount off your initial consultation fee.
Today's episode was produced and edited by Nicole Lockett.